This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you. From daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow. A real person.
Yep. I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow. I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something.
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 40% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
All right, Tim Zimmer back at the studio telling me to go on air. I'm not quite sure what he wants me to do, but it's 6:19, and I guess we've taken a break. Tim, you're going to have to direct me here, buddy, because I don't know what the hell's going on. I'm flying blind. Todd Bell joins us, professor and director of the political management program at George Washington University. Talk about the latest on the budget battles. How are you, professor?
Morning, Thomas. Good to be back with you. I'm doing well this morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Pardon our dust, but remodel we must. We got a couple of things going on, which is challenging, but we'll get through it. Tell me what's going on with the challenges in Washington and the budget battles there.
Yeah, the budget battle is a real big controversy here. We obviously have the 30-day continuing resolution that was passed. It has some increases for veterans affairs. It has some increases for the military and Homeland Security, but some cuts for a lot of domestic programs. And that's what really angered a lot of, particularly the progressive Democrats, when Chuck Schumer, the minority leader, switched what his strategy was last week. He said he was going to fight it, and then a day later he said he wasn't, because he thought that shutting down the government would actually give Elon Musk and the president more time and more authority to continue some of the cuts they've been making.
So what is the end result here with the debt, first of all? Does it increase debt or does it decrease it?
No, we still have the debt ceiling needs to be addressed. So within 30 days, the House and Senate are going to have to figure out what they're going to do about debt ceiling.
Let me clear up, Professor. I didn't mean to make it sound like debt limit. I meant the debt of the country. A deficit year-to-year for the audience, debt overall, and we're talking about saving here, but if it increases the debt, we're not really saving anything. We're shifting money from one area to the other and basically still spending more money than we're taking in.
That's exactly right, and we have been doing that throughout the first few months of the year. The debt is still going up because we are still running deficits. Now, one of the things that the Republicans are going to try to do is put together a a deficit reduction package that includes what's called the budget reconciliation, which tries to bring things together where they're going to have cuts, but they're going to offset a lot of the losses of revenue of the tax cuts with some of the spending cuts, which they're trying to implement already. And this is going to give them the ability. This is just some of the friction between Elon Musk and the department heads at the cabinet meeting a couple of weeks ago, is they need to get on the same page so the cabinet heads can then go to Congress and say, it's okay to have these cuts. We don't need these specific programs, and that will give some of the cover to members of Congress to pass the bill that will reduce the deficit.
So tell me what's happening with the politics of this. Who was Trump? Or it was Trump and Schumer, right? Or the Congress and they were Democrat and Republican, and I'm trying to figure out who would have eaten it politically if the government had shut down.
Right. One way to really look at this is who's inviting the shutdown and who is not, who's more anxious about it going into it. And obviously, Donald Trump and Elon Musk were saying, bring it on. We want the shutdown. Oftentimes, Congress is the one who gets blamed for the shutdown, not the president. And Schumer realized that he was not in a real good position. They wanted a 30-day extension, and then they would have some more time to negotiate and have some more Democratic input on the budget bills. But this is not the full slate of cuts, and this was not the real fight that Schumer wanted to have. So I think he was right. I think it really would have given more power to the president, Elon Musk, in the short term. But he's thinking a little bit more long-term, although probably at the risk of really alienating a lot of people in the Democratic Party. There's a lot of infighting going on right now.
What about within the Republican Party infighting? And did this play well with the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, with the, what is the Freedom Caucus, I think, the extreme Republicans?
Yeah, it's amazing. Almost everybody except one member, Tom Massey, is on board with the Republicans. Remember, this is the issue that cost McCarthy his speakership a few years ago. And, you know, without Trump's help, you wouldn't have had Speaker Johnson retaining his speakership and getting this through. The leadership in the House is all very, very pro-Trump. It's different than just a few years ago because now Trump is president, and a lot of these people don't want to stand in the way of what he wants to do. A lot of these Republicans who were sort of the disruptors and voting against their leadership, they were doing it because they wanted more cuts to government. They wanted to go to Washington, D.C., shake it up, and make the government more responsible in terms of lowering the debts and deficits. And that's exactly what Elon Musk is doing in their eyes. And so they are completely on board. We now have the Republicans unified and the Democrats more fragmented.
In their eyes, but is he really lowering the debt or the deficit? That's what I'm trying to get to the bottom of, because it's easy to say we have a political win here. You know, I'm team red, I'm team blue, I won, I lost. But ultimately, it's all about the bottom line, right? If you're an accountant, it's the balance sheet or the financial statement, whatever you want to say. And what do those numbers tell us?
Yeah, and this is why we've got this 30-day continuing resolution and figuring out what those overall numbers, that's going to come in these longer budget bills that will take us through the end of September throughout the federal budget year. We don't have those numbers yet. In fact, the CRS is putting together the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, putting together what they call scoring, which is assessing what the impact on the debt and the deficit will be in the longer term, because, you know, a lot of these cuts are being overturned by the courts, and they're saying, you know, no, send it back. You can't impound that money. And we don't really have a lot of clarity yet. And we don't even know exactly which tax cuts are going to be in there, because on the revenue side, you have to think about what is going to be the loss in the revenue and where that's going to be made up by some of these cuts.
So to be clear, this goes until 30 more days or until September?
Well, they're going to have to negotiate the formal budget bills that will go through September. They haven't done yet. This continuing resolution just goes for another 30 days. And then in about 2.5 to 3 months, they may have to raise the debt ceiling, which they haven't done yet.
So what happens in 30 days?
In 30 days, we have another, you know, potential shutdown of the government if they don't get the budget those fast.
But it would seem as though those negotiations would start now, right? Because 30 days is going to happen pretty quickly.
I mean, Congress isn't in session, but they've been working on these bills as well. And it's not like they're starting from scratch. They've been already, the budget committees have been putting together proposals that they have. They just have to sell them and get the types of amendments from the other members that they want in there.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Somebody texted in and said, Republican leadership winning swimmingly. Stay tuned for more. Same person texted in and said, Trump highest approval rating yesterday in 20 years. Somebody else says, shutdown has a boogeyman. Shutdowns aren't bad, and Reagan did it a bunch. Nobody dies or starves. I know traditionally federal employees, as we talk about Department of Government Efficiency, all that ends up being is a paid vacation for government employees because they've never not been paid for the time they've been furloughed. So I don't know that that's making the government more efficiency. 627, I guess we're going to traffic, taking a break, doing something now. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. 629, Tommy Tucker, quickly back to our guest. Talking about the budget continuing resolution that was passed for 30 days, which has to be looked at again in 30 days. Todd Belt, professor, director of political management program at George Washington University. I wouldn't run a grass cutting service this way, let alone the federal government, but that's what they're choosing to do. What do the politics say? Where does the polling stand with Trump's popularity, Congress, et cetera, professor?
I'm sorry, Tommy. I made a mistake. I need to correct it. This continuing resolution that was passed and signed on Saturday actually goes through September. It's not the 30-day one that I thought they were still working on.
Yeah, because that seemed crazy.
I got a couple of. Well, they had done a. Remember, they did a 3-month one at the end of December. You know, and we've been working on continuing resolutions for half of the year. But there are no real, you know, structural changes other than the ones that I said to Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs.
Real quick, Professor, I'm sorry, but we have a mess going on here. Who's winning politically on this one?
Right now it's the Republicans, I think. The Democrats are really fragmented on this. The Republicans are getting some of the cuts that they wanted. Democrats did not get really anything in this because it was completely written by Republicans. They're hoping that when they get the regular budget bills that need to be negotiated and implemented over the summer, they'll have more input.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. We come back, we'll talk with Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about some coastal parishes suing oil companies. Right now, time for WWL First News. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 6:45 on this St. Patrick's Day. Just a fine morn out. 48 degrees right now. It could be a beautiful day going up to 69, 74 tomorrow, 79 on Wednesday, 66 Thursday. Another shot of cool weather comes in, 68 on Friday. Saturday looking great. Plenty of sunshine, highs of 76, and then maybe a chance for showers on Sunday. Dane Cialino joins us now, our friend, professor of law at Loyola. And we got a whole lot of stuff to talk about. Good morning, Dane. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
You too, Tommy. Good morning.
Let's talk about, on a less happy note, what's going on with the first execution that Louisiana's carried out in quite some time. Tomorrow, I think, is when it's slated for. Tell me about the legal process that was involved here and what the arguments were.
Yeah, it's been an on-again, off-again execution right now. As of this morning, just before 7 o'clock on Monday morning, it is on for tomorrow evening. The Louisiana Supreme Court yesterday, late in the afternoon, denied an effort by the condemned individual and his lawyers to have the execution date reset for a date 30 to 45 days out in accordance with a Louisiana statute that appeared to require that. But nonetheless, the court in a 5-2 decision denied that request. So now the only recourse that these plaintiffs have is to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and ask that court for an emergency stay of execution.
But the legal argument was interesting because he wasn't saying, don't execute me. He was saying, execute me this way. But there was a strategy and a way behind that, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's always strategy in what these lawyers are doing. They were just in the effort before the Louisiana Supreme Court that was unsuccessful yesterday. They were just looking essentially for 30 to 45 more days of time to work on what no doubt would have been a petition for review by the entire Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal court in New Orleans, and a review by the United States Supreme Court. So right now they are running out of options. The execution is scheduled for tomorrow, and unless one or more justices step up from the United States Supreme Court to stop it, it's going to go forward.
Would it only take one if one of the liberal justices were to say stop it, or I don't know what the legal maneuver would be or legal proceeding would be, but would that stop it?
Well, there's one justice who is assigned to the South, essentially to the Fifth Circuit, mm-hmm. who can decide to stay the execution temporarily.
Who would that be?
The entire court. I should have checked, but I don't know which justice is now currently assigned. It was Justice Scalia for many, many years, but of course he died 5 or 6 years ago. There is one justice assigned. I don't know who it is offhand, but it's going to be up to that justice this morning to decide whether to issue an emergency stay.
And that's all luck of the draw if it's somebody that's Alito. Wait, that's the one you said that died?
Scalia died.
Alito is the one that's assigned to the 5th District now, and he falls on the conservative side?
Yes. If it's Justice Alito, then he is one of the more, if not most, conservative justices mm-hmm. on the court. So they would be unlikely to get relief from him.
You know, when it comes to the philosophy of cruel and unusual punishment, it is a somewhat subjective thing. I just wonder how the courts have ruled or determined what's cruel and unusual.
Well, in this context, it's whether or not the execution method would impose undue extra pain that is unnecessary to cause death. And that's the whole issue with nitrogen hypoxia as a method of execution. Of course, other methods of execution have been specifically ruled to be constitutional, like firing squads, electrocution. But the United States Supreme Court has never definitively ruled on nitrogen hypoxia. They have declined review in several cases, most recently in Alabama. And it's starting to shape up that's probably the most likely result here is that the United States Supreme Court will deny review. What's different in this case is there was a fairly detailed district court opinion from Judge Dick in Baton Rouge that, as a factual matter, found that nitrogen hypoxia would cause undue pain based on her weighing of expert testimony on her consideration of eyewitness reports from the Alabama execution. So it was a bit of a surprise to see the Supreme Court act so quickly in the wake of such a fairly definitive ruling from the district court based on factual weighing of evidence and making factual determinations.
And with the appeal, he wanted a firing squad or physician-assisted death. The only execution methods in Louisiana that are approved are nitrogen hypoxia, lethal injection, and electrocution. But so firing squad wouldn't apply because it's not legal in Louisiana. You got to go by what the law says, right? And they've had problems with lethal injections and either getting the drug cocktail or people to use it or to administer it.
Exactly. And in Alabama, there was a slight difference that the firing squad method was available as a choice to the condemned individual. That's not the case. That's not the case here.
Thank you, Dane. We'll take a break. Pick it up. We come back 6:51, 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. It is 6:56, 4 till 7. Dane Cialino, our guest, professor of law at Loyola. We talked about the death penalty case already. Let's talk about Plaquemines Parish v. Roselle. And Dane, one thing before we start talking about this, I see that Judge Clement is going to preside over this. And I had jury duty not too long ago, and he was presiding, I think, over criminal case. Does he do both? Is that the way it works? Take me through that.
Yeah, in Plaquemines Parish, the judges there hear both civil and criminal cases.
Okay, so tell me about this case and what this going on and likelihood of how it turns out.
Well, these are called legacy cases. They've been brought for the last several decades by private individuals, by municipalities, parishes, school boards against oil companies for essentially failing to remediate damage caused by drilling operations over the preceding 50, 60 or more years. The arguments being that after the companies finished drilling their wells, they had to clean up the property, and they failed to do so. So the plaintiffs in many of these cases have sued for damages for remediation. The lawsuits are fairly controversial because over the years people have complained that the plaintiffs sue the oil companies for money to remediate, then they take the money and put it in their pockets, pay the lawyers, and never fix the land. The legislature has stepped up and changed the law in some respects, but here this case is a slightly different since it's a parish bringing the cause of action against the oil companies, and the allegation is that the operations 50, 60 or more years ago have caused Plaquemines Parish to lose land, and that land loss is what they're seeking compensation for.
So they opted for a jury trial, and one thing I wonder about is the parish is the plaintiff, and the judge is a Plaquemines Parish judge. Did they try to get this heard somewhere else?
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover, all for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy!
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Almacid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Almacid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almacid.com. That's almased.com.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do they want to have it heard in Plaquemines Parish?
Well, they want to have it heard in Plaquemines Parish because the plaintiff's hope is that the jury will be sympathetic
defense,
to their...
the other way.
Right, right. Well, the defense really cannot move these large-scale lawsuits that affect every parish resident and every judge in the parish are... specifically excluded from the recusal article. So, no, the defendants are stuck in Plaquemines Parish, and they're going to be there for the next several weeks as this case is argued before 12 Plaquemines Parish citizens.
Judge Clement said 5 weeks. This is going to be very complicated stuff, I presume, Dane?
It is. The damages models are complicated. The dollar amounts are immense. Billions and billions of dollars are at stake.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Oh, real quick, when it comes to cruel and unusual punishment, people are saying, why don't you just give him an overdose of fentanyl? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? You got to follow what the law says and what the legislature approves, correct?
Absolutely. If it's not in the statutes, then the warden at Angola can't administer it.
Thank you, Dane. Appreciate it as always. Have a nice St. Patrick's Day. We'll take a break. Talk to Jeff Palermo about LSU, men's basketball, men's football, women's basketball, and more when we come back. 7:14, St. Patrick's Day 2025, Tommy Tucker. And it's going to be a beautiful day, a couple of different celebrations. It sucks that the parade got canceled on Saturday, but man, it's going to be perfect today. And they got the Irish Channel stuff going on. They got a fundraiser for St. Michael Special School. A lot of different things going on. Jeff Palermo joins us now. WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Jeff.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you, Tommy.
Although I'm guessing you're probably more of a St. Joseph's Day guy.
Yes, I would be more of a St. Joseph's Day guy. You're right.
But you can be Irish today, and then yep. I'll be Italian on Wednesday. It'll work out.
Yes, yeah. We all get a day.
Let's talk about LSU football and spring practice and what Brian Kelly decided to do.
Yeah, there will not be a spring game this year. They had scheduled a spring game on April 12th. Now, we're starting to see this across the country. One of the reasons given by some of the coaches is that when you have a spring game, it allows other programs to really, because most of these spring games are now televised, it allows opponents to take a look at your second stringers and third stringers and then try to pull those guys off your, then allows them to then try to recruit those guys off of your team to their team. Now, Brian Kelly said that's not necessarily the case on why he's changing things up. So what LSU is going to do is they're just going to have an open practice inside Tiger Stadium. And Coach Brian Kelly says it will actually give them more time to work on special teams. It will allow them to work more on goal line situations, red zone situations, third down situations, instead of just having a game where you can't necessarily you can't work on goal line situation unless it actually occurs during the game. So this will allow them to really do some things that you get 15 practices during the spring. And Coach Kelly said the other thing is sometimes they would use that 14th practice to kind of get ready on how they would warm up and all that stuff for the 15th for the spring game. So he wants to maximize the use of his 15 spring practices and doesn't really want to pigeonhole himself to a spring game in that final game. The other thing that LSU is doing on that April 12th is once the practice is over, fans will then have the opportunity to get autographs from the players, from the coaches. Back in the day, maybe I guess 10, 12, 15 years ago, LSU would have a fan day in August where fans would get an opportunity to bring posters and you can get autographs from the players. Well, that went away. So they're bringing it back here, and I think that's a good thing, Tommy, because in this day of the transfer portal and guys coming and going, I think it's sometimes hard for fans to get a connection with some of the players on the team, and this will allow them to at least have that opportunity. And I know for kids and stuff, it will be cool if you can go out there and get Garrett Nussmeier's autograph or something like that, Caden Durham's autograph. So I think that's a good move from LSU's part.
Have you ever seen when they do that at Alabama and the people that are waiting and then rush on the field?
Yeah. Well, Alabama's had, especially when Nick Saban had it rocking and rolling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would sell out their spring game, but mm-hmm. it seems like
when it came time to meet the players and then and Alabama people that were there running on the field to meet the people.
Yeah, well, I also look at it, too, as, you know, in college athletics, which is becoming more professional. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know about when the Saints hold a training camp, and what's great about training camps in the NFL, it gives fans access that they obviously you just don't get, right? You get to go watch the practice. You get to hang out after the practice. Players come by, autograph, and those are things that I think are special, especially when you have a family and you can't afford to go to the game, but you can take your kids to the training camp practice and get autographs afterwards. And so LSU's at least one day bringing that opportunity for LSU fans in April.
I think we're talking past each other here, and I don't think you're grasping my point, which is to ridicule the fans of Alabama.
I don't know. I'm paying attention to what LSU's right. doing, Tommy.
I'm just saying, if you've seen footage of it, it'll raise your eyebrows.
Okay. All right.
Let's talk about LSU baseball now and beginning SEC play.
Well, it was a great start for the LSU Tigers. They really handled Missouri, and they should. Missouri is probably going to finish in last place in the 16-team conference. It was an opportunity right off the bat to get off to a great start, and they did that. Offensively, the Tigers were fantastic, I thought. They constantly put pressure on Missouri's pitching staff, scoring 29 runs. They only hit 4 home runs. That's been a theme so far throughout this season, that LSU doesn't necessarily need to play long ball in order to win games. I know a couple Fridays ago they hit 6 home runs in one game, but this is a team that can just score runs in a variety of ways. They get on base, and 1 through 9 through the lineup, every guy is a problem. You know, even Michael Braswell, who has really struggled this season, had a big game on Saturday night. He drove in 3 runs, and 2 of his runs that he drove in were on squeeze plays. So, again, I think that's a really good sign for LSU offensively. If you're looking for something to keep monitoring and watching is your 2 of your starters could not get past the 4th inning, Anthony Ianson and Chase Shores. But there's guys out of the bullpen that Coach Jay Johnson could really rely on. And Zach Collin on Friday and Sunday, he was good on both days. Connor Ware was good on Saturday and Sunday. And Anthony Ianson was terrific Saturday night, holding a 1-run lead for 2 1/3 innings. So there's options. And that's something that, you know, even in the 2023 season, LSU didn't have a lot of options once he got past Paul Skeens, Ty Floyd, and a few other guys. Now, some guys developed as the season went along, but early on in the season here, Jay Johnson has options out of the bullpen. So if an Ianson, Shores, or even a Cade Anderson on a Friday only can give you, you know, 5 innings or whatever, there's guys in the bullpen that they can go to. Now, will those guys out of the bullpen get tired by the end of the year because they're being used so much? We'll wait and see. But I still think LSU is in a really good spot with its pitching staff.
I know you're worried about LSU or concerned about LSU and focusing on LSU as you should. But considering Jordan Fiegel and our general manager, Dan Barron, are both graduates of the University of Alabama, I never pass on an opportunity to take a shot at them.
Okay.
7:21, we'll take a break, talk women's basketball at LSU when we come back. Right now, time for traffic on WWL. 7:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our good friend Jeff Palermo, WWL.com. Columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. You'll find a lot of stuff that he's written and posted at WWL.com that'll be interesting reading. Let's talk, Jeff, about those Lady Tigers and where they landed in the LSU basket in the NCAA tournament.
This is the 4th season for Coach Kim Mulkey at LSU, and for the 4th consecutive season, LSU is a 3 seed. So, of course, in the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament, the top 4 seeds in each region have the opportunity to host the first 2 rounds, so LSU will be home this weekend. They will face 14-seeded San Diego State, who won the Mountain West Championship, the Mountain West Tournament Championship, to automatically qualify for the NCAA Tournament, so LSU will spend time breaking down San Diego State. If LSU wins that game, they would play the winner of Florida State and George Mason on Monday. By the way, that LSU San Diego State game tip off at 9:15 inside the PMAC on Saturday night, 9:15 p.m.
For TV, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I know. But really the big story for LSU is its health, because what we saw in the SEC tournament, Flaje Johnson was held out because of a shin injury, and then Anisha Morrow, one of their top players, a double-double machine, she re-aggravated a foot injury. And it's, you know, if those, they need Michaela Williams, they need Flaje Johnson, and they need Anisha Morrow to be healthy. And if those three are healthy, those three are as good as any other threesome on any other team in NCAA women's college basketball. And so, really, it depends on them. And, you know, Coach Kim Mulkey said both of them, they're good to go. They're still in walking boots, but that's more of a precaution. And she thinks by Saturday night, those two will be ready to go, and hopefully they can stay healthy through the tournament.
Jeff, I try to keep track of this and remember, but I can't. Tell me how far the women's basketball team went last year.
They got all the way to the Elite Eight, and they lost to Iowa.
That's right. Now, men's basketball declined the NIT invitation. I always thought the NIT was an interesting tournament because it used to be you could say we're number 65 in the nation. Now I think you can say we're number what, 69?
Yes, you could say you're number 69. LSU said it had injuries, didn't have enough players, but really the real reason is it's just time to move on to the next season. LSU finished 3-15. In SEC play, lost in the opening round of the SEC tournament. Right now, Matt McMahon and the staff need to focus in on getting better players in. The NCAA or the transfer portal is opening here, I think, in about another week to 10 days. And so the focus with an increased NIL budget, somewhere around $5 million is what's being reported. Try to use that money and bring better players to Baton Rouge and see if that doesn't result in wins and an NCAA tournament berth next year.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just see the clock. In terms of NIL money, how's that divvied up between programs?
Well, it's really up to how much a program can raise. And men's basketball has been lagging at LSU. And the only way for them to compete is they got to get more money. And there's a lot more here because you got revenue sharing starting and all that, but we'll have to talk about it some other time, Tommy.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you. Appreciate it as always. Have a great week and a really happy St. Joseph's Day. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, as we always do. We'll take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street with Mark Rosa. Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Time now, WWL First News. All right, 7:46, 14 till 8, St. Patrick's Day 2025, joined by Mark O. Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Top of the morning to you, Mark.
And good morning to you, sir.
What is Rosa? Is that Italian? Hispanic?
Spain? Spain, yes.
Barcelona?
Yes, that'd be nice.
I didn't know if it was or not. I just wanted to say Barcelona. Tell me what's going on. We talk about the wearing of the green. What about the saving of the green and the making of the green? What's going on here with Wall Street and the stock market and everything?
Tom, you know, we touched on inflation news that was released last week for February, but it's worth just spending a few seconds on that again this morning. So, and the Fed meets this week. I'll get to them in just a second, but we had better than expected on the consumer price index and the producer price index, better than expected numbers that came out, and they lowered the year-over-year numbers that the Fed is watching so closely. Who cares? Well,
Mark, let me jump in for a second, please, if I may, because you're talking about a CPI and a PPI, right?
Yes.
Can you just explain to people what those are if they don't know?
Yes. And I will.
This is like you're like in surgery. You're in surgery. You're a doctor. You know, you scalpel this, that, the other. We don't know. We're unconscious. Okay.
Well, if the Federal Reserve, the nation's central bank, is seeing that inflation is going up, there's a likelihood that they'll raise interest rates to slow the economy down. That's monetary policy. That's their job. Mm-hmm. On the other side of that fence is if they're seeing that inflation is coming down, something that they spent a lot of time on over the past year and a half, they are more inclined to lower interest rates, something that the whole country would benefit from. So it everybody's on Fed watch. We've said that over and over. So what's the deal? They're watching these inflation numbers. So from a producer price index on a wholesale level, it's what companies will see on raw materials, will see what products or services they're providing on a producer level. So last month, meaning January, the monthly report was at 0.4%. Well, that's a monthly report. You have to multiply it by 12 to get an annual number that makes more sense to any listener and or the Fed. So 4 times 12 is 4.8%, way too high. So we're waiting for the January numbers to come out. The expectation was 0.3. That would be good because it's down below what it was in January. It came in at zero. There was no change from the previous month, so that's fantastic news. Now, that's a 1 month. So what they're also doing is anybody that's publishing economic data, they're saying, well, what has it done? Average it out over the past year and see what the direction of inflation has been on an annual basis. Well, after that zero reading, the January 3.7% annual rate came down to 3.2. That's fantastic. What the Fed has been looking for, and they've repeatedly said, they wanted to start with the 2. So 3.2 is good news, down from 3.7, yes, but they're still very, very hawkish about where this is going and watch it very closely and comment every time after the numbers come out. So you segue over to the consumer price index. After prices are coming in on a wholesale level, it translates into what could happen on a consumer level. So consumer price index for January was high, just like the wholesale numbers, but it was 0.5. That's a 6% annual rate, way too high. What's going on? Let's wait to see what's going to happen next month. Comes out at the expectation was 0.3. It comes out at 0.2. So that's excellent news. And the overall, the year-over-year for consumer price index has only risen by 2.8%. So that's what we're feeling as consumers. That's what the Fed is seeing as the number starts with the 2. That's what's making them happy. And what's not making them happy so far is all of the new administration. They had what's called, and I'll say this, I'll segue back to it. They had in December, what's called the dot plot. All of the people that get together at the Fed, it's called the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. It's a group of Fed governors that sit on the Federal Reserve's board, plus some of the regional banks' presidents. They all get together periodically, pretty much every time they meet, which is 8 times a year. They discuss what's going on with the economy. What does each of the governors see in their areas of the country? And they do a dot plot. It's like throwing darts at the board, but a little bit more accurate than that. Each one of them allegedly submits, well, this is what I see, and somebody on the West Coast could have a different take on inflation and what the economy is doing than somebody on the East Coast. So they all get their answers up. They put those dot plots and see what the consensus is. Where do these Fed governors see inflation going? And what would they do with interest rates to combat that if inflation is going up too much? So that the last time it came out was late last year. So the Fed meets. They have a meeting this month, this week. They're going over numbers as they normally do, but news says they're going to release another dot plot, which the market is very much anticipating because they haven't seen one, an update, since 3 months ago. And it's like, what is the Fed thinking right now? Well, what is, like my boss at UNO, Dr. Lane, was saying, it was on the news this morning, that it's like all these tariffs are the issue. They're saying that they're watching the tariffs very closely. It's bound to increase inflation. It's making the Fed's work that much more difficult. And if what really needs to happen is if the tariffs are being used by the administration to kind of wake up some of the other governments that we're having these trade imbalances with, well, then maybe it might be short-lived, and that'll come down. If it's dragging on, like Dr. Lane was saying, well, it's going to increase inflation because it's an increase in prices. So they were, in December, when that dot plot came out, the Fed was saying, well, we're looking at 2025, and maybe we'll have 4 interest rate reductions. This morning news had an update on that, that they're maybe looking at two. So the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, they have gotten this Fed Watch on their website where anybody could, it's free and open to the public. You could go to the CME.org and look at their Fed predictions. Now, these aren't just people flipping a coin. These are investment managers from around the country that are bringing in their thoughts about what the Fed is going to do from a monetary policy standpoint, more specifically about what they're going to do about rates. So this week, at 99% chance, there's no rate changes. The next meeting in May, same thing. It's about an 84% chance that are no rate changes. However, it starts to take a different tact when we get into June. There's a 70% chance of a rate decrease in June. That's what the market is feeling, when will be the most convenient time or the most appropriate time to lower rates amongst all that's going on in the economy, meaning tariffs included. And then there's another expected rate drop at the September meeting. So they have so far forecasted at least two rate drops. Everything's on the table. It could change overnight. They plot those predictions that anybody can see. And when those percentages are rising, now late last year, you and I were talking about, we looked at every Fed meeting for 2025, and there was no reasonable expectations for any rate changes. That was the wait-and-see time going into a new administration. So it's had a lot of impact, meaning the administration, what they're doing, has had a lot of impact on what the market participants are seeing as Fed action this year. I, for one, would love the interest rates to not ratchet down a little bit to better the economy, because it will make borrowing costs a little bit.
But let me jump in real quick, Mark. I got to get this question in, because if the interest rates come down, housing starts and building houses stimulate the economy like crazy, right? Yes. Because so many things are involved. Yes. Well, if that happens, isn't that going to lead to inflation and more spending?
Well, that's it. So what they have to watch to say, or we do for a rate decrease amongst everything else going on in the economy, is the economy slowed sufficiently that if it sped up a little bit, it would still be within the Fed's window. So they're still looking at, and Tom, we've had decades when we enjoyed, one, no Fed influence at all. We weren't on Fed watch. The economy was doing wonderfully well. This is pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. And we had average 2.5% inflation going on. So that's what contributes to a really robust economy. And I think what the administration is adding on to this to help the economy is, and help inflation, it's a mass reduction of a lot of regulatory constraints that are on business right now, and regulation across many areas of the economy, they say, and or predicting that that's going to bring inflation down. So there's a lot on the table, and the market has been jittery. And it was down 300 points in pre-market, but that's improved. So right now, if it opened, it's down about 120. But still, the Dow is over 41,000. So as we've seen a lot of volatility, it's not been so bad. I think year-to-date, it's only down about 5%. So that's not that's within kind of a margin of error. But that's where we are this morning.
Got to run. Thank you, Mark. We'll talk to you Friday. Valuable information as always. Monday, we'll help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Time now, traffic, WWL. 8:17 now on a St. Patrick's Day morning. If you're watching a Players' Championship yesterday, you know it ended in a tie, and the playoff has begun with J.J. Spawn. And all, I guess appropriately on St. Patrick's Day, Rory McIlroy from Ireland.
Street Easy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. but that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, Street Easy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
March Madness is here, and if you want to enhance the experience, join me, Gary Parrish, and my colleague Matt Norlander on the Ion College Basketball Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. We have new episodes at least three times a week and at the end of every night of the NCAA tournament. So before you go to bed, hang with us or know we'll be there when you awake. We'll break down games, make picks against the spread. Most of all, we'll have a blast. So join us on the Ion College Basketball Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
And they're on the first playoff hole, and I say this because I know there are a lot of golf fans listening, and Rory's looking at birdie, Spahn's looking at a par. Tim Temple joins us now, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, to talk about the insurance market in New Orleans. Good morning, sir, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you as well.
You a golfer or not, Tim?
I am not. I wish I had time to play golf and other things, but right now my days are taken up working on dealing with this insurance crisis, and I'm glad to be doing that.
It takes a lot of time, I'll tell you that, both. We're playing golf and working on the insurance crisis. I'm sure golf sometimes can be more rewarding than, again, maybe not. Let's talk about the results of what's been done so far, because I'm getting texts from people saying nothing's changed, my insurance is still. Matter of fact, I took a look at what I paid my home off, or at least I'm in a position to, haven't yet, going to wait to see how some things play out, but if I start paying it myself and not the escrow, it's going to be $6,500 each year for the homeowner's insurance that I'll have to pay. And I'm paying it now. I just don't have to write the check because of the escrow. Flood's $850. What is the average rate? Do you know, Tim, that people pay for homeowner's insurance in Louisiana?
Yeah, you know, we just on Friday, we had a Senate Insurance Committee hearing. And during that hearing, the legislative auditor reviewed the report that they did on the Louisiana Fortified program, and they had an average premium of, I want to say it was right around $5,600.
And so I'm a little bit above the average.
Statewide.
Yeah, and that's, if that's the average, then I would imagine the people even south of where I am are paying a lot more than that.
Yeah, and look, Tommy, I hear, you know, ranges all over. I mean, there's obviously, you know, people even in your listeners, you know, area, Orleans and Jefferson, and that are paying well above the $6,500 you mentioned. You know, for homes that, you know, you also got to think that our average home value in Louisiana is somewhere just around $200,000. And, you know, I was looking and talking to some folks last week about California. And you look at what their average home value is somewhere around $900,000. And their average premium was well below the $5,500 I just mentioned for Louisiana. So, you know, there's different risks. There's different issues. We're tackling that. And, you know, you had referenced the progress we've made. And last week we issued a release that just to let people know that the reform is working. And that doesn't mean it's going to be for everybody, these rate decreases that companies are taking. But I think that's the thing that I want everybody to focus on, is that companies are taking filed rate decreases. They've started doing that, and, you know, I anticipate that continuing unless there's, you know, it's always up to Mother Nature and you know, tornadic activity and right, especially hurricanes. But we're doing the things that we need to do in Louisiana, the things that we can control.
Did you say taking filed? Did you say taking filed rate decreases?
That is correct. We have,
what does that mean?
I think it's eight companies that have filed it. That means when they renew, when they start offering their renewals and their formulas, it's rate decreases.
I got you. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back, because I think it goes to, and you and I, Tim, talked about this last year when the session was going on about managing expectations, where it's not going to be quick, but the journey, what's the saying, of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. We're talking with Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, about what can be done. You can't force people to write insurance, about what can be done to ease the rates and increase competition in the homeowners market. 821 traffic now, WWL. All right, 826, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. Tim, we talked about, you know, it was going to be a while, and it was going to be, I guess, slow but steady progress when it comes to homeowners insurance, hopefully. Let me get to some listeners' questions here, if I can. Ask Mr. Temple if the next round of the fortified homes will include Covington, because the last three have not. Thoughts?
Yeah, so Covington is North Shore, so I'm trying to remember if that is in the round of coastal communities. Mm-hmm. I guess Covington is.
They said they have not been in the past, so I guess they're wondering if anything's going to change about that.
Yeah, look, we're one of the things that I'm doing is this session, I am bringing some legislation to create permanent funding for the Fortified Roof Program, so that and what we're going to propose is increasing some of the fees on insurance entities, and insurance folks, and then also asking the legislature to allocate a portion of the property premium tax that we all pay when we pay our homeowners insurance to go toward the Fortify program, so that we know every year that that money's there, you know, without having the legislature to come in and allocate some. So if when we get that funding, then I think that allows us to be more flexible, because, you know, obviously we want to create a program that can benefit people no matter what part of the state you're in. Fortified roofs, and that might make sense in Covington, but it may not make sense in Monroe. Mm-hmm. There's different types of programs I want to try and create with the state. So to answer the question, I don't think that they're in the current round. We're trying to focus on the deep coastal communities, because that's where those fortified roofs make the biggest impact, that makes the biggest difference.
Tim, I don't mean to introduce a red herring here or anything, but a fortified roof's not going to help you with a tornado, is it?
You know, I don't think it is, but you can put one thing that you can have are hail-resistant shingles. Mm-hmm. And one thing that, you know, these shingles that are put on as part of the fortified program, they're built to withstand 150-mile-an-hour winds. But I think, to your point, when you get that really concentrated, you know, rotation of wind, if it comes over your home, that's, you know, I don't know what you can do to mitigate against a tornado other than build everything out of steel and concrete.
Yeah, you scare the hail out of me, pardon the pun, when you mention hail-resistant shingles, because I had to replace a roof because of a hailstorm, and that'll get you out of nowhere, and the deductible is pretty high. Let's talk quickly, Tim, in the time we have left, about a minute, about auto insurance and what can be done in the session. Where there's a will, there's a way, but with the trial attorneys, I don't know that there's the will. What are your pre-session political conversations tell you?
Yeah, Tommy, look, I agree with you. I don't see the will for you know, in a large, you know, big group of folks. There are certain legislators that are supportive of it. There's, and I'd say many legislators, but it takes more than many. It takes the majority, and we need to have a session to address this crisis. I've for over a year, I've been saying we need a special session. That's not going to happen. But we will have legislation this upcoming fiscal session to continue to try and create auto reform in our state. It is the one thing that, just like, you know, you may not own a home, so homeowners insurance may not impact you. You may rent, you may live with someone, but everybody that drives a car has insurance, whether it's your personal or your commercial. And it is the issue of the season, if you will.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate your time. And next time you come on, we'll talk about what's in your purview, what isn't, when it comes to auto insurance and even homeowners insurance. Because, again, I don't know why you wanted this job, but you got it. Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. There are only so many things he can do, especially when it comes to auto insurance, because that's dependent on the litigious atmosphere in the state and the laws. And that would be up to the legislature. We'll come back, talk about how big the Super Bowl was for New Orleans. Right now we pause for WWL First News. 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL on this St. Patrick's Day. I'm going to tell you what, I know I have been through every Super Bowl, really, I'll say, that's been here in New Orleans. Some of them, you know, I was just a Liberty kid for us. I don't really remember. Some of them involved as a member of the media. This one did seem different to me, and I don't know why it is. It's hard to put a number behind it or a reason behind it. But Jay Cicero, who joins us now, president and CEO of the Greater New Orleans Sports Foundation, will be able to tell us just how huge and how different it was. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How you doing?
I'm all right, sir. Congratulations on a job well done. Does it even begin to sum it up?
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You know, that's what the Sports Foundation does. In this case, partnering with the New Orleans Saints and Mrs. Benson and the Saints leadership to lead us to what I think was a pretty successful 11th Super Bowl in New Orleans. It was a great experience, and I'm happy to play a great role in it.
I think that's understatement at its finest. You've been through a lot of these, Jay, and at a very high level. Did this one seem different to you as well on a personal level as it did to me?
It absolutely did, Tommy. You know, we really set out a couple years ago, this being our fourth Super Bowl that the Sports Foundation has served as the host committee staff. We said, what can we do differently? And starting with just the logo itself, our host committee logo, created locally by a group called Boombox. and the ability to look into the history of Super Bowl in New Orleans and combine that with the unique culture that we have, really put that on display. And intentionally using the structure and some of the people that have been involved with Super Bowl in the past 30 years with us, to make sure that we take advantage of every opportunity that comes along. And I think we were able to do that.
If this, and look, I understand it's a very competitive process, but if the NFL wasn't happy with this, I don't know what they want. I got to presume the feedback you got from the NFL was extremely positive, Jay?
It has been very positive. Obviously, this event in particular and these major events are very cumbersome. They're riddled with issues and problems that you have to take care of along the way. But overall, very positive feedback. And the complications of doing such a, or the logistics of doing such a complicated event really have to be taken apart. And we're doing that right now with all of our partners here locally and with the NFL and doing after-action reports to make sure that we learn everything that we could do better and everything that went right. And I think we have a great sense that a lot went right, and we're very hopeful that that will lead to somewhere down the line a record 12th Super Bowl for New Orleans.
Yeah, that was my next question. I presume at some point there's some type of, for want of a better phrase, performance evaluation where you guys get together, I don't know, at the NFL office or wherever, and I don't know if it's the Sports Foundation or whomever it is, somebody meets with the NFL and y'all kick it around about what happened, this could have been better, this was great, this was awesome, we'll do this at the next Super Bowl, whether it's in New Orleans or not?
Yeah, we you know, with the Sports Foundation, we do that with every event that we host. And sometimes it's difficult to have people be critical of themselves or critical of their performance, but it's the only way to grow and be better each time. And so, yes, we do converse with the NFL. We do converse with all of our partners here locally, all the venues and the airport and everyone else. What went right? What went wrong? What can we do better? And if we do get a chance to bid again, what would that look like?
Let's pick it up there. We come back talking to Jay Cicero, President and CEO of the Greater New Orleans Sports Foundation. I got a text from Tim Temple coming in just to clarify. Tim Temple, the insurance commissioner on a fortified roof program, it does currently extend into St. Tammany Parish, but just the extreme southern portion of I-12. Thanks, Tim, for following up on that. 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. Till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jay Cicero, President and CEO of the Greater New Orleans Sports Foundation. Most watched Super Bowl of all time, even though it was not that tight of a game. 6,400-plus members of the media, over 20 countries covering the event, and 104,000 fans went to the Super Bowl experience that showed some big local engagement. Jay, when you talked about, you know, I heard you say, if we get a chance to bid on another one, tell me about that process and New Orleans, the possibilities of New Orleans hosting a 12th game.
Well, certainly those numbers you just related were record numbers too. Record number of media, record number of viewers, like you said, for a game that wasn't that tight. If it would have been, it would have a tight game, I think that the viewers would have been higher. I think it just goes to show you the value of New Orleans and the ability, the growth of the Super Bowl, and it continues to grow each year. So the ability for us to, be invited to bid on the next on a next Super Bowl really has a number of factors involved with it. The first being a calendar. You can't get it 2 years from now. That's not the way it works. You've got to avoid Mardi Gras, the second weekend of Mardi Gras and the weekend after Mardi Gras. And so, looking at those dates down the year down the line, as well as the conventions that New Orleans and Company and the Convention Center and all the hotels have booked in the future. Some of these conventions are booked 10, 12 years out. So. That calendar is a little tricky, and so we really have to be the right city and the right year and the right time to make it happen.
Do you have Just from looking at the reading the tea leaves, do you have a year, the soonest possible year that New Orleans would be able to or be invited in? It just being realistic about it, to have another Super Bowl?
No, we don't have that yet. We're always, you know, we're talking to the NFL about wrap up for this Super Bowl, and certainly the next one is always on our mind. But like 2029 is the next available Super Bowl, and it's over Mardi Gras weekend. So you have to work through all of that and able to at least get a chance to convince the owners to invite New Orleans to bid. And certainly Mrs. Benson and Dennis Lauscher from the Saints and their group play a huge role in that. And, you know, she made the pitch last time. She made the final pitch to the owners for us. Back in 2018, and I assume she would probably be in the same role, not only getting us invited, but being able to play a significant role in the pitch to the owners to be awarded our record 12.
Real quick, 30 seconds. You know, I keep a notebook. When things pop into my mind, I write them down. I presume you guys do the same thing when it comes to Super Bowl. Well, you know what? We don't have one, but that'd be a great idea for the next one.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of... there's a lot of little tweaks here that we do, and we learn from other cities too. Right? We really take notes from other cities, from other events. We see what folks do here for Jazz Fest or French Quarter Fest or Essence Festival. So, you know, that would be a great idea for Super Bowl.
Jay, God bless y'all, man. Y'all did a great job. Congratulations. I'm not that old. I'm in good health. I want another one before I go, okay?
Thank you, Tommy. Me too.
Thank you. All right, my friend. We'll take a break, come back, talk about the history of the Irish in America on WWL. St. Patrick's Day 2025, and I hope you're enjoying the day and maybe engaging in the wearing of the green, perhaps. I want to thank Armando Gonzalez, who is the Regional Director of Technical Operations for Odyssey out of Dallas, Danny Miller, Ernie Kane, team of engineers, and others that have all come together to upgrade the studios at WWL, and they're working like crazy to get us up to the latest standards and have all the bells and whistles. And thanks to those guys and ladies, I don't know how many are involved, for working so hard to keep WWL sounding great. We appreciate it. We really do. And we hope we're not making it hard for y'all. We're just trying to keep the water flowing, as you say. The water will be green in Chicago today as they dye the river for St. Patty's Day, and we thought, or St. Patty's Day, actually. And we thought we'd spend an hour talking about the history of the Irish in America. And Kevin Kenny joins us now, Glucksman Professor of History at New York University. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Would it be cliche to say top of the morning to you?
Not at all. Top of the morning to you.
And would the rest of the response be in the rest of the evening to you, or the rest of the day to you, something like that?
Something like that, or may the road rise before you.
Are you from Ireland, I presume?
Yeah. I'm from Dublin originally.
I had the pleasure of visiting your country almost 10 years ago now, and I was just blown away. You think of it as lush and green and beautiful, and with the lakes, and it doesn't even begin to describe how beautiful the country is, and I hope I get to go back. So let's talk about quickly, if we can, the differences between St. Patrick's Day here in America and Ireland.
Oh, that's a good question. So the difference between St. Patrick's Day here and in Ireland, I'll tell you, when I was growing up in Ireland, St. Patrick's Day was a fairly small festival. It was one day off in Lent. So if you were observing Lent as children, that meant giving up candy. Mm-hmm. As alcohol, as adults, meant giving up something a little stronger. You got one day off school, and you got one day off Lent, and there might be a small little parade or festival. That's all changed, and now St. Patrick's Day over there is a big festival with leprechauns and shillelaghs and the rest of it. And you know, the interesting thing is a lot of that was imported back into Ireland from America.
It's interesting, huh? about life imitating art, however you want to look at it. A fun side note, there's a young lady who grew up in the Irish Channel, Brandy Corkin, that went to school at Northwestern State University. And that band actually marched in the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Dublin and for a long time in the airport. She's a young Irish young lady with red hair. And her picture was at the Dublin airport, which is funny because you would think it would be an Irish band or an Irish person, but it was from America, and it just goes to how the, I guess, the cultures go back and forth. Let's talk about what led to the Irish coming to America, what with this talk that we have now of immigration, and how they were received. The conditions first in Ireland that led to them coming here.
Yeah, so like actually the first thing we have to understand is we have a story that Irish emigration to the United States began in the 1840s, right, with the big catastrophe, the Great Irish Famine. And I hope we'll talk about that today. But the first thing we need to understand is that there were Irish in the United States and in New Orleans long before that. So there were Irish people started leaving that island in large numbers around the year 1700, right, a century and a half before the familiar story begins. And those Irish were Protestants. They were Presbyterians. They were the ancestors of the people today that we call the Scots-Irish or the Scotch-Irish. The name varies. So there were significant numbers of Irish coming to America, coming, as I said, even to New Orleans in the 18th century and in the early 19th century. And actually, if you were to look for when St. Patrick's Day was first celebrated in New Orleans, I believe it would have been in 1809. Some people may say earlier. But the people celebrating that holiday were the Protestant Irish, not the Catholic Irish. And it's very important that we recognize that heritage. Because there's about 35 million Americans today claim Irish heritage at any time. Of course, on St. Patrick's Day, everybody claims Irish heritage. But at any one time other than today, big chunk of the American population, about 35 million. But a lot of them are of Protestant Irish heritage. So as a historian, I just wanted to make that point, and we can talk about that if you wish.
Yeah,
but
I wish you
would.
Big
event.
Go
ahead, Tommy.
No, Professor, I want to hear, but I got 1,000 questions, so you keep talking, and I'll interrupt when I sense you stop.
Yeah, and so the big event then that comes a little bit later and is decisive is the Irish famine in the 1840s. That's the big, well-known event. There is a prehistory before that. The big event is the famine.
When it comes to the famine, one thing I learned in Ireland, and it goes to the song "The Fields of Athenry," and I got to be careful here because a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of what goes on are the troubles, as they say, between the Protestant and Protestants and the Catholics in Ireland.
Yeah,
it was not about religion, as a lot of people think. It was more about, I guess, the crown and about how Trevelyan had enough food to feed the people, but he chose to import it, and that led to the famine. Am I off base there or not, Professor?
You're not off base. So I'll tell you what happened. In 1845, there were 8.5 million people living on that island, 8.5 million people. The number of people living on the island today is still only 7 million.
Wow.
Right, so it's begun to grow over the last quarter century or so, but the population of Ireland reached its all-time peak in 1845. And what happened over the next 10 years, with 5 years of famine and then sustained emigration, is that the population of that country was reduced by one-third. Now, that's a demographic catastrophe without any parallel in modern European history. 1 million plus died of starvation and famine-related disease. 2.1 million people fled that country as emigrants. And if you want to look really for the foundational myth of Irish American history, the more familiar Irish America, the Catholic Irish America, because now with Catholics who are leaving, you find it in the famine. And the idea is, to quote one Irish nationalist exile, his name was John Mitchell, and he moved from Ireland into the American South. He lived in Tennessee. And John Mitchell said, the Almighty indeed sent the potato blight, but the English created the famine.
Mm.
So there was a potato blight, sure, you know, but you have to distinguish between crop failure and mass starvation. So that's the, if you like, the foundational nationalist explanation of what happened in Ireland in the 1840s.
And that's why I wanted to have you on and clear that up, because that came as a surprise to me. Just, you know, and we can talk about the troubles and so forth, but I always thought it was about Irish and Protestant, and it really wasn't. It was about one government starving a generation of people, right? I mean, would that be accurate?
It would be accurate, but the religious side of it is important, right? Okay. Irish history, the religious side is always important. So, look, Ireland in the 19th century was a colony of the British Empire. It was so much a colony that it was basically just gobbled up, so close to the island of Great Britain that, you know, Ireland never stood a chance strategically. It had to be conquered and governed. It was England's first colony. And Northern Ireland remains, you could say, England's last colony. So we have to understand this in terms of Ireland as a colony of the British Empire. Within that context, Protestant people had relative privilege. So whether they were Irish Protestants or whether they were English or Scottish Protestants who moved into Ireland, they made up about 25% of the population. But in terms of land ownership, in terms of political office, in terms of any measure of opportunity and privilege, Protestants stood above the dispossessed, impoverished Catholic population. Right. So you can see that you can't actually understand the colonial relationship in Irish history unless you plug religion back in.
So I guess I'm wondering, was it, did the religion drive the political part of it, or did the political, or was the religion just part of the political part of it?
Maybe
I didn't phrase that properly, but
I know exactly. No. You did phrase it well, and the answer I would give is, like, if you step back from this process for a moment, and you what I would say is that you've been to Ireland. You just described how beautiful it is. It's a small island off the northwest of Europe, and its great historical misfortune is that it happened to be located next to a larger island that created the biggest empire the world had ever seen, the British Empire. If you look at it in that context, Ireland is a stepping stone for invasion of England by the French, by the Spanish. If you just look at it in strategic terms, Ireland didn't stand a chance. Ireland was always going to be conquered by its more powerful neighbor. Now, everything else is justification and rationale. People can say, oh, the Irish are poor, the Irish are inferior, the Irish are Catholic. The imperial ruler can say, we're better, we're more civilized, we are Protestant, the rest of it. But all of that is just justification for a powerful neighbor exploiting a weaker neighbor. And that history often works that way, I think.
It does. Let me take a break, Professor. We'll pick it up when we come back. If you all have any questions or comments about Ireland, we're talking about it with Professor Kevin Kenny, Glicksman Professor of History at New York University, about the history of Ireland on this St. Patrick's Day. We'll talk about the troubles when we come back and the history. I know I'm an old film guy. As you guys know, I love old movies, and you can find movies about the troubles going back to the 20s and the 30s and beyond that. So it's been going on for quite some time. And a bus driver told a joke, Professor, I don't know if you've heard this or not, about in the days where a Protestant left a bomb in a Dublin hotel, and a Dublin manager came back and ran out and gave it back to him. That's how prevalent it was. Nah, funny now, not then. We'll take a break, return. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us on this St. Patrick's Day 2025, WWL. St. Patrick's Day 2025, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A lot of activities going on today in the Irish Channel. We thought we'd spend an hour talking to Kevin Kenny, Glucksman Professor of History at New York University. If you've been to Ireland, give me a text at 504-260-1870, the Oquinar Jeweler Talking text line. I'd love to know your thoughts on the country. I know it's on a bucket list for a lot of people, and I was fortunate enough to go. Professor, when it comes to the Troubles, and I mentioned old movies, Victor McLaughlin, an Irish actor that was a boxer, and he was in The Quiet Man. He's the guy John Wayne fought, if you saw that movie. But his first movie, or one of the movies he was in early on, was The Informer, where he plays a guy with the IRA that informed on a fellow member and pays the price for that. In The Quiet Man itself, there's a mention of the IRA. Tell me about the history of the Troubles, if you will, throughout the years and how finally they came to an end, or if they are at an end.
Yeah, the history of the Troubles, the big, big question in Irish history. So if we think of Ireland, as I described it, as a colony, the first and last colony in the British Empire, some people in Ireland, especially in what we call Northern Ireland today, like that relationship. They favor being part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern
Professor,
Ireland.
Let me jump in for a second, if I can, because I know when you cross over into Northern Ireland, you got to change your money, and I guess, in essence, you are in Great Britain, are you not, or am I wrong?
You are indeed, yeah. Okay. So you stop using euros, the currency of the European Union, and you start using pounds, sterling. So the island of Ireland was partitioned. It was cut into two different sections in 1920. The creation of two different political entities on the same island. 26 of the 32 Irish counties won their independence from Britain and its empire. But six of the counties up in the north remained part of the British Empire. So today you've got the Republic of Ireland, which has 26 counties, but you've also got Northern Ireland, which is six of the 32 counties that remain part of Britain and the last colony, if you like, of the British Empire. And that's where the Troubles begin, right? Because if you zero in on Northern Ireland, one of the two states on the island, right? You've got the Republic to the south, you've got Northern Ireland, which remains part of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Well, within that small area, until recently, the majority of the population, being Protestant, want to stay part of Great Britain, but the growing minority within that six-county area are Catholic, and they want to break that relationship and reunite Ireland. From 1968 to 1998, you had the period of the Troubles, and that was the outbreak, really, of a civil war within Northern Ireland between the growing Catholic minority who wanted to reunite with the Republic of Ireland and the small but diminishing Protestant majority who wanted to retain the relationship with Britain. That's what the Troubles are about. Now, this has big repercussions internationally because there is an Irish diaspora. People say that maybe 70 million people around the world have Irish descent, and somewhere in the region of half or more of them are here in the United States. And the American Irish and some pretty high-ranking political figures helped broker a peace deal that did bring peace to the island. It's a fragile peace. It's an unstable peace. But the period of the Troubles right now is at an end.
Professor, when the troubles at the height of it, was it just Northern Ireland, or did it extend the part that was Ireland in and of itself?
Yeah, it almost never came south. I was a teenager growing up in Dublin during that period. The worst of the troubles was in the 1970s, and there was one bombing campaign in Dublin, and that was launched by the what we call the Loyalist side. The Protestant paramilitaries came down into the Republic, and they did a bombing campaign one day. But nearly all of the violence in the Troubles was confined to that small section of the island that is called Northern Ireland. So it was a small little place with a small population. Relative to the size of that population, a lot of people were killed.
The hour is flying by, Professor. Let's take a break. We come back. I want to talk about the Irish in America, because I don't think they were very well received initially. Again, like you're saying, on St. Patrick's Day, everybody wants to be Irish. That was not the case back when they first came to America. We'll talk about that when we return, talking to Kevin Kenny, a Glucksman professor of history at New York University from County. What was it, Professor?
I'm from Dublin. City of Dublin.
Okay. 9:35, 25 till then. Boy, that statue that is there with the pigeon droppings, you got to clean that, Professor. I'm just kidding. 25 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It's St. Patrick's Day, so we thought we'd talk about the history of Ireland, and now we move on to the Irish in America. Kevin Kenny is our guest, Glucksman Professor of History at New York University. And, Professor, I was in Dublin, and I was kidding about the statue earlier. I don't know, who is it in some square, whatever, that statue that's, it's white is what it is because of the pigeons. There's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
But I was in a pub, if that's how you say it, and I ordered a Jameson's with ice. And, man, you thought I had said something bad about somebody's mother. Apparently that's a no-no.
That's a no-no, yeah. You wouldn't adulterate Jameson's with ice. You might put water in it if you were faint of heart.
How do you feel about all of these flavored Jameson's whiskeys?
Not my favorite thing.
No, I didn't think they would be. That seems like an Americanization of an Irish product. But let's move on. You say that everybody wants to be Irish on St. Patrick's Day, and I think you're right, but I don't think you would have wanted to be Irish back in the 1840s when they were coming to this country, would you?
No, indeed, you would not. The Irish who came here in that period faced a huge amount of prejudice. You know, if you were in New York City at that time, in 1850, 1860, just after the famine, about one quarter of the population was Irish-born. So one in four people was born in Ireland. So this famine migration had a big impact on the cities in Boston, in New York, in Philadelphia, in New Orleans too. And native-born Americans, looking at these immigrants, initially they didn't like what they saw. They didn't like that these were the poorest European immigrants they had ever seen. And they had a lot of prejudice. They didn't like how they looked, how they dressed, how they smelled. They didn't like the language they spoke, because a lot of them spoke Irish. And above all, they didn't like their religion, because nearly all of these poor immigrants coming in as a result of the famine were Catholic. And they were coming into a country at that time that really defined itself through Protestant religion, and that looked very suspiciously on Catholic immigrants. It's a bit hard for us to understand today, but anti-Catholicism in American history survived right through the 19th century, you could say until 1960. When John F. Kennedy was elected president, he had to explain to the American public. He said, "No, I am not the Catholic candidate for president. I am the Democratic candidate who happens to be a Catholic." You could say that Kennedy's election, you know, put the last nail in the coffin for anti-Catholicism. But until then, hostility to Catholics, suspicion of Catholics, was really very central in American culture. Now, why in the 1840s would native-born Protestants have been suspicious of Catholics? Well, they said, you know, they're not fully American. There's a hyphen there. They're Irish-American. They're Catholic-American. Their ultimate loyalty lies to the Pope in Rome. And, you know, they don't like our public school system. The public school system is one of the great accomplishments of American democracy. But these newcomers, they want their own schools. They want their parish schools. We have other ideas to do with temperance, moderation on consumption of alcohol, anti-slavery and abolitionism, and they don't seem to be going along with us, right? So there's a huge cultural conflict. And I would say what the significance of the Irish arrival, especially in terms of religion, is they stuck to their guns and they said, no, we want to become Americans. We can become good Americans, but that doesn't mean we have to give up our heritage, and particularly our religious heritage, in order to do so.
Professor, talk, if you would, about the importance of the development of America and the part that the Irish played in it, and also, was it at their expense, and were they justly compensated for it?
The Irish provided a lot of the brute physical labor to build the infrastructure of this country. So Irish men were laborers, so much so that the American term for a common laborer in the 19th century was a paddy. So a laborer was a paddy. The Irish dug the ditches, they broke things, they built things, they built canals, they built railroads, they built the infrastructure of cities. Sometimes in the South, they did jobs that were considered too dangerous for others, including for African-American slaves, because slaves were property. The Irish were expandable. I'm not saying the Irish were worse off in general, but I am saying that, right?
No, so, sure. And look, Professor, I just wanted to address that. It's an elephant in the room. A lot of people say whenever you talk about slavery, they say the Irish had it bad. But I think what you just said, it puts a real ribbon around it. And that's a bad phrase, but it summarizes it where slaves were treated terribly, but at least people thought that they were property. And I'm not justifying any of that at all. That's not what I'm saying. But, the person said, well, okay, at least I have something to lose here. The person that owned the slave, as wrong as that was. But with the Irish, it was expendable. I think that's a tremendous way you put that.
Yeah, there is some truth in that. And obviously, in saying that, I'm not in no way diminishing the unique horror of slavery. I mean, African Americans, after all, were owned as property.
Exactly.
But that's the whole point. The Irish were expandable. There are cases, there are real cases, where the Irish were put to work draining swamps in Louisiana and building infrastructure, building canals, and dying of malaria. And if you invested in the human property of owning another human being, you'd suffer a loss, right? In no way, in saying that, am I saying that the Irish were worse off than African Americans?
No, I understand.
I'm just pointing to two forms of exploitation.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, the Irish built the country.
So, what about
that
Professor?
Way.
And I'm just looking at the clock here. So, we look at what they received in return for the contribution they made, and your thoughts would be what?
Quite a lot, because unlike black people at that time, they could enter the country freely. They could move around. They could get jobs. They could naturalize as citizens. They could vote, and they could hold political office. And although the Irish were discriminated against when they arrived, overall, the American-Irish ended up doing really well, really quickly, from a historian's point of view. Within a couple of generations, even the most impoverished of the famine Irish were making huge strides economically and politically, partly because they were white.
What's the situation in Ireland today, Professor? And for Irish Americans, we'll close it that way.
There, You know, Ireland is part of Europe, but it gravitates towards the United States. The United States is a hugely important part of every Irish person's identity. Every Irish person on that island has connections with the United States. It's a positive and very important relationship, and it's mediated by a diaspora of tens of millions of people with a heritage in Ireland, but with a homeland abroad, and nowhere more so than in the United States.
As for the Irish in America?
Looking at Ireland?
Well, just in general. Just in general about the progress that Irish people have made in America, and are they on an equal footing now with everybody else, or ahead?
They're more than on an equal footing. Mm-hmm. If you were to measure how people of Irish descent in America today, people who identify as Irish American, if you measure their social situation by any conventional measure, whether it's income, occupation, education level, or home ownership, they're above the national average.
When it comes to, as a historian, an Irish historian, a native of Ireland, if you would have a couple of words of advice for Americans that you would never, never, ever like to see them do again as far as Irish culture or wanting to be Irish, what would you say?
I really wouldn't.
Because,
let me
tell you why. Because here in New Orleans, we have our own thing, and it's like watch a movie, and it's like, come on, don't do that. Don't. Really?
Yeah,
that's not how we... Exactly.
I get it.
What would you say?
The caricature of the Irish, I get it. the Irish today are a pretty savvy, sophisticated bunch. You may go over there in search of, some romantic past and some pure Irish peasantry, and you could go into a pub looking for that as a returned Yank, and they would happily string you along and tell you whatever you wanted to hear, but don't believe a word of it.
That is an awesome way to end this, Professor. I've enjoyed our time. Have a happy St. Patrick's Day.
You too. Happy St. Patrick's Day to
Kevin Kenny Glucksman, Professor of History at New York University. They will happily string you along, but don't believe a word of it. 9:54, quick break. We'll find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.